where you said the status quo is unacceptable. Otherwise, you wouldn't be a church planner. You'd be throwing your resume into a staff job somewhere. Or you become a church planter or want to be a church planter because it's hip now, and that's very dangerous. See, I'm also old enough to know that when I started church planting, there were like two books on church planting. There were no ABC specials on church planting, and church planters weren't invited to talk on Nightline. Nobody was a church planter. Now it's like the hot commodity to be a church planter. So check your motives very carefully. But probably something in you, I'll assume the best motive, said, there's something wrong with the status quo. I see something that should be different, and I'm beginning to formulate what that is. And that enters you into a whole process called imagination. Before you start the church, before people say to you, how did you do this at your church? Before people say, would you come speak about this at your church? There was a time of just sitting and thinking, what is wrong? What would I do different? Could I actually have avoided the things that I didn't do right? And I spent a lot of time writing in sketch pads. I literally have like two drawers. I had articles tacked up on the wall. I had things written on the wall. My wife walked in one time, looked around, and like shut the door. I'm like, what's the matter? She goes, it's a little too beautiful mind in there. It was getting like a little crazy. But that's the imagination phase, right? Everything is about church planting. I'm watching a movie. I'm like, here's the lesson from church planting in that movie. My kids are like, it's a movie. Just lighten up, Gandhi. We're not going to talk spiritual stuff right now. But the imagination phase, you begin to think about what could be different. And that should include more than you by yourself. If it's you by yourself, you're not really living a kingdom component of Christianity. We're not called to be hermits. We're called to be in community. So it should be you talking to other people, you reading other people's stuff, and you visiting other churches. And out of this wealth of imagination comes a period of preparation. If you're a visionary church planter leader, the imagination phase is your strongest point. You can talk all night about what could be, and you can get excited about sharing that vision, and other people respond. That's how you can tell if you're a gifted visionary leader. Other people start responding. Where your weakness will show is when someone who is not a visionary leader, who is an engineering type, says, how do you plan on doing that? That sounds really good. How do you do that? And you just start telling them again what it will look like. And they pretty quickly realize this guy sees step 1, 2, and 27, but this guy has no idea 3 through 26 even exist. And that's where you really need to understand that part of the mission of church planting is always just living out the gospel, and part of the gospel is living in community. So we started not as the lone guy like I did the first time. We started with a team of people. And someone who was more geared toward being an executive church pastor was the guy who started saying, okay, these are great ideas. Let me tell you, this can't exist at the same time as this because it requires too many people and too much money. This can exist only once we develop this. And he began to organize all these things that I just saw in kind of a cerebral vomit. You know, like this is what should be. And he took it and sort of organized it. And then after that preparation phase comes this phase of activation where you launch the thing and suddenly, you know, like it or not, you're a church planter. It's a lot like being a parent. It happened. You had a lot of fun getting ready for it to happen. And now you have to take care of everything that happened after that. Where all this idea comes from, though, it's not just a prequel, not just what happened before in a church plant, but what happened when God incarnated in Christ Jesus. Everything that I learned right about church planting, I learned from the incarnation of Christ Jesus. I would say, and it's one of those big statements, and I like big statements, you know, the most important verse in the Bible about the incarnation, John 1:14. And the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us, and we beheld His glory, glory as the only begotten Son of the Father, full of truth and full of grace. So there are two things that are describing who God is in character. Full of truth. Everything He says is right. Every judgment perfect. There is no such thing as subjectivity or opinion. The very words and ideas of God are objective truth. And He's full of grace. That's something I'm not, right? Grace to me is relative to how good of a morning I've had. Good day, I'm pretty gracious. Bad day? Nope, dog hides. You know, it's just you're relative. You're not these things. God was these things before the incarnation. They did not change. The piece that changed in the incarnation was that he tabernacled among us. That's the critical piece to the mission of the incarnation, that now God was no longer contained only in the ritualistic, civil, and national law of Israel. God was now contained in a person, and he brought grace and truth present to those people. Jesus became the image bearer. It's the Greek word for icon, and it's as though you have a computer and you have this one little picture, you know, that blue W that means Microsoft Word, but you click on that W and all the encoding that is that software package comes forth. That's what Jesus was. He was the icon. And so it was the presence that really made the difference in understanding how we would do incarnation. If you're thinking about the prequel to church planting, the most important thing you can be thinking about as you're following after Christ is John 1:14. What does it mean to be present? Because that's what it means to be missional. Where the church often has failed is it said, what does it mean to be attractional? How do I get people to come to me? Or what does it mean to be truthful? And if we're just full of truth and we just open the book, people should come. Or what does it mean just to be gracious? And if we just tell people we like you and you can use our basement to have AA meetings, well, people will come to church. But what does it mean to be present, full of grace and full of truth? When I look at that with Jesus, I recognize the largest problem in this equation. I'm not Jesus. My presence is not always full of truth or full of grace, and my presence sometimes isn't even particularly present. Guys, and I'm speaking particularly to the men here, the women probably run through the same issues. As men, when we live out a fallen nature, there are two things that happen to us. Instead of tracking after God and being a reflection of Him, and just being the things He wanted us to be, being how Adam was supposed to be, being how second Adam is, we end up doing one of two things. We either abuse the position of power that we're given as the image of God. You know, take David, a man after God's own heart. And when he's given the position of kingship, what does he do? He uses his elevated position, physically elevated in the palace, to look out at the people who are the apple of God's eye, and he uses it to become a peeping Tom. He uses it to draw the woman to his house, and he uses it to commit murder to cover up his adultery. That's a guy who's abusing his position. The other thing that we do is we abdicate. We won't take responsibility. It's not my fault. These kids today, they're just like that. It's God showing up and saying, Adam, what happened here? You're in charge. I gave you the word. I spoke to you before I created the woman. You were supposed to tell the woman. You stood there. What did you do? It wasn't me. It was the woman that you gave me. So we have to get rid of between this life of abuse and abdication. But what does that look like? Well, I can't always find that in just saying, I want to be Jesus, because I recognize the gap between the perfect one and the holy one. But I can see people who are faithful and following Jesus in times that are more like ours than any other time. When I look at Paul, and I see Paul in pre-Christian Europe being present, truthful, and gracious, that makes a lot of sense to me in post-Christian America. I want to turn to Acts 17 real quickly. Acts 17, Paul's been leading up by following a pretty familiar pattern. He's been going through Berea and Thessalonica, and he goes into the synagogues because he understands the synagogue. This is what he was trained in. He can open the Hebrew Scriptures, and he can talk the Hebrew Scriptures to other Jewish people. He's been doing that. People argue with him, and some people are converted. He's sticking with methods and models that he's comfortable with. And then he finds himself in Athens, and he's waiting for some partners to catch up with him. And it's in that little period of time called waiting that God changes everything in his life. It's not the period of him planning. It's not the period of him running to another synagogue. Look at verse 16 in chapter 17 of the book of Acts. Now, while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue, that's what he was used to, with the Jews and devout persons, and in the marketplace. This is the first time we see him come out of the synagogue in the book of Acts. And in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him. And some said, what does this babbler wish to say? Others said he seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. And they took hold of him and brought him to the Areopagus saying, may we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting, for you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean. Now, all the Athenians, this is their cultural icons, all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. All right. So here's Paul. He leaves the people with whom he's most comfortable, and he walks out and he sees a city full of idols. He's left Judaism to see pagan pre-Christian Europe, and his heart is moved. He's engaged. He's passionately engaged. I would say that he's full of grace. Just like Jesus was in the incarnation, he's filled with grace for the people there. He's not going, they're a bunch of idolaters. I just want to smash these people. I came to Christ in my early 20s. And for those of you in the room who came to Christ a little later in life, you probably could walk through a litany with me of just Christian crazy that is out there that smells nothing like Jesus and looks nothing like anyone you want to be. I'm at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, go Badgers, and there's a guy walking around with a giant cross. And he's walking through the courtyard, pointing at people going, you're a whore. You're a sinner. You're a whore. He wasn't doing it in like a Ron Burgundy voice. He was just sort of like just saying that over and over again. And I'm thinking, I don't want to be like that guy. That's not particularly... If being a Jesus follower means I have to walk around a Big Ten school calling people whores and sinners, I don't think I like this religion very much. And then he pointed to my girlfriend who was a punk rocker, half shock white hair, half black hair, who'd been through a lot in her life. She was covering up from a lot of wounds in her life, and calls her a whore. One of her sexual wounds was that she was raped as a teenager. So now I'm lit. I mean, I go for the guy. And a sociology professor steps in and starts shredding this guy in the Bible. The guy knew nothing. He just knew how to insult people. So there's the one Christian I see who's like present and how he behaves. Then later in life, I'm living in the Arts District of Albany, New York, and I'm going to the independent theater that I used to work at and go to, and there are these Christians circling the building. They're kind of dour looking, like constipated would be the word I would use, and they have these signs, and they're circling the theater, and it's because I'm going to see this movie called The Last Temptation of Christ, a Scorsese film based on Nicholas Kazantzakis' book, and not full of any truth. And as though these Christians expected the pagan movie world to make a movie about truth, they're out there angry. Instead of saying, hey, here's a movie where they're mentioning Jesus, do you say we actually use this and talk about Jesus? Nah, let's go protest these people. So they do. They walk around, and these are the kind of people I see. Later, the Christian church sort of caught on, you know, when they overlooked the fact that Mel Gibson didn't agree with all their evangelical theology, but they were all about the passion of the Christ, and they sort of learned we can actually talk about this. Paul has a heart for these people that moves him towards these people, not a heart of condemnation. If you find yourself living in an us-them out of anger, you need to repent of that. And there may be groups. There may be groups whose sins offend you to a level personally that you have trouble having grace for those people. You need to be able to identify that and repent of that. You'll find the people that you used to judge in your life are still there. Still there, and you may find they come back. I had a bit of an authority issue, still working on it, growing up, and so I didn't always find like law enforcement agents as the people that I most wanted to be with in my life, okay? And then I start Terra Nova, and we're supposed to be the artsy church in the artsy district. You know who's at my church? Two FBI agents and a DEA agent. I get to know these three guys, three of the best men I've ever met. All those old silly bigotries have to start to die because God may bring people to you who you need to be gracious to that you had no heart for. Paul walks out to a city of idols as a Jew who hates idolatry, but he has a heart for those people. Then he runs into the Greeks, and they're arguing philosophy, the Epicureans and the Stoics. One's arguing the Stoic side, life is hard, so you keep a stiff, upper, joyless lip, and you get through and you don't cry. And that's how you make it through life, right? It's pretty dry, pretty tough. The Epicureans are sort of the opposite. You know, they're like, hey, there's a lot of good in life. Eat really rich food, have a couple drinks, laugh it up a little, because you're going to die anyway. And he's out there discussing and dialoguing with both these groups, which tells me if he's dialoguing, he actually listened. He didn't just wait for them to say something that wasn't true from the scripture, cut them off and say, but the scriptures say, that's a conversation ender with someone who's not part of the truth. I mean, I knew a guy who was a music teacher in our area, and he was trying to teach me drums. Life teaches you what you're not gifted at after a while, right? I tried like seven musical instruments. I can't play any. I'm not a musical man. I want to be, just can't be. And I'm trying to play drums. That's like my last hope because I'm figuring if you can do this, you know, like maybe I can be a musician. It still didn't work. One day he says to me, you know a lot about the Bible, right? I said, I know some. He said, I'll tell you what. I'll start teaching you drums for free if you give me Bible lessons. Because I listened. We were engaged in a dialogue. It wasn't, I just want to shove truth down your throat, and unless you agree with me, I reject you. That's truth without grace. So Paul's out there dialoguing with these guys to the point where they say, why don't you come to our place? The opposite of the attractional, right? Paul isn't saying, and when you're ready to hear more about the argument, you come on back to the synagogue. They say to Paul, come to Mars Hill. Come to the Areopagus. Okay, let's do a quick review of Mars Hill. Who remembers Edith Hamilton's Book of Mythology? Anyone have to read that thing in high school? Mars is the god of war. Any coincidence in God's setting that Paul walks onto the hill owned by the god and dedicated to the god of war to show us how to actually do culture war? Because it's not what we think. Culture war wasn't about pointing out what bad idolaters there were. He walks in and says, here's what I perceive about you guys. You're incredibly religious. He's able to find a compliment in the midst of all their idolatry to say, this much is true. You guys are religious. Now he goes on to say, I found an altar to the unknown God, but therefore you worship as unknown. This I proclaim to you, the God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by hand, nor is he served by human hands, as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of every mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods, the boundaries of their dwelling, that they should seek God in hope that they might feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he's actually not far from each one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being. As even some of your own poets have said, for we indeed are his offspring. Did you ever look up what poet said that and what it's about? That poem is about Zeus being the great God and father of everybody. It tells me two things. One, Paul was aware of the artistic and cultural commodities of his day. He quoted this thing off the top of his head. He was not afraid of cultural statements that didn't carry truth. Two, he was smart enough to take an access point for the gospel, lift it out of the context of that poem, and say, this is true about God. The things that you guys say is true about Zeus, that's true about the unknown God. The other person he quotes is sort of a cult leader, and he takes a piece of truth and is able to quote that. A lot of Christians have become very bad at being present because they're uncomfortable in culture. They don't know how to behave because we did something very dangerous for mission. We created a subculture. We're like the boys and girls in the plastic bubble. You remember that? The guy who's in the bubble and he can't be with anyone because if he gets like any virus from them, whatever, he's going to be dead, right? So that's how the Christians act. We build this bubble and you get your kids and you want to protect them in the bubble. So you get them videos of talking vegetables that only talk about the Bible stuff, and you get them like little fish toys, and whatever's popular, you find like the Jesus version of it. You know, it's like instead of Power Rangers, you get them Power Prophets, and this guy morphs into Jeremiah. You know, you're like, your kids aren't going to be normal when they go to school, just so you know. And we live in this total bubble, and we don't know how to be present. Paul was present. Paul's quoting poems to these people, and he's using them to get people to Jesus. He's not using them as the whipping boy. He doesn't know just enough about culture to say, see how evil these guys are? Pick the cultural genre. You can pick movies, you can pick rap music, you can pick indie rock, and you can see the church where it's been the whipping boy of these things and says, look how bad these guys are. These men and women are terrible. Look what they produce. And they sit there and point fingers. And I came from the arts culture. And let me tell you, there wasn't a whole lot of love, and still isn't, between the arts culture and the Christian culture sometimes, because all it does is sit there and condemn from its sidelines. Paul doesn't do that. He's incredibly present, intellectually enough where he knows what's going on, spiritually enough where he can use it and benefit. So how do we bring that to our world? I'm going to try to do this pretty quickly. We don't always understand where we've come from. You know, we just wake up and we're in this crazy world called the United States of America, full of people from every place and every tribe, tongue, and nation, and we ask ourselves, how did we get here? Well, it started as this agrarian first republic, which was just a colonization of Europe, and things were done largely like they were done in Europe, and the people who came over ruled. Their elders were the governmental leaders, and in the 18th century, in the 1700s, the Presbyterian, Congregationalist, and Anglican churches ruled the day. Then change happened. And suddenly change happened faster than ever before. Change happened because people invented the combustion engine and the railroad was driving people out west, and people were cross-pollinating ideas faster than they ever did before. Alvin Toffler, who wrote Future Shock, says, change happens at the rate that you move people and ideas, right? Because you're cross-pollinating faster, you're learning new things faster. Well, those guys in colonial America, they moved about the same speed as people in biblical times, so change wasn't that fast. Then the West opens up, and we come into the Second American Republic post-Civil War, and it's this industrial age, and everything's moving differently, and you have these two little teeny denominations called the Methodist and the Baptist, and by the end of that century, they are the two biggest denominations in America. What happened to the Presbyterians, Congregationalists, and Episcopal? They had the universities, they had the monies, they had the cities, but they weren't ready for change. They no longer were able to incarnate to a shifting time. Because what happens with the church is this, and it happens with people too, it's easy to freeze frame your favorite time. You understand it, and you get comfortable there, so you just want to keep it. I'm half Irish, half Italian, so I'm genetically Catholic. Church I grew up in? 16th century, right? Men in black dresses, and it's not considered weird. It's because that's what teachers and professors wore in that day. Art, only the art that you would have seen in the 16th century. Stained glass and reliefs, there's no film, there's no electric guitar. We did have like one guy play folk guitar mass once. My father took us out and he goes, damn, hippies are in the church now. This was Doc Marcel's response to that change. But they freeze frame their favorite time. To the point where when my mother was growing up, they still spoke Latin in the Mass. Because those were the good old days. You get into fundamentalism, and they freeze frame the 1950s. It's still about fighting communism. Right? I got handed anti-communist literature the day after I got saved in a Bob Jones fundamentalist church. That's the truth. You get into evangelicals, they think, well, we're not afraid. We're not freezing time. Oh, yeah? Did you ever look at the dates on the contemporary music slides? 1985. You know, this is like when I was in high school. That's not contemporary anymore. Just ask my kids. In a world of hyperchange that we live in, not the industrial age, but the information age, we live in such rapid change that trends can't even be predicted, they say, anymore. It used to be that you predicted a trend and you lived it out for the next 20 years and then you had the time to predict the other. Now it's constant viral change. So to incarnate to our time means simply you have to be exactly who you are when you are. So that's going to come back to moving from a culture to a person in a culture. Paul will say to Timothy, take heed to yourself and to your teaching. And I think that's really part of understanding incarnation, is taking heed to yourself. Who are you? Where do you fit in? Who do you talk to naturally? We are made, all of us, who are indwelt by God, to be like perfectly crafted puzzle pieces to smuggle the gospel and the kingdom where no other piece will fit. Everything you've been through has shaped you to be unique in that incarnation. And when I'm talking about culture, I'm talking about three things, just so we can have a common definition. Words, cues, and artifacts. By words, I just mean simply the language that you say. You can be speaking with a certain group of people, and they know exactly what you're saying, right? You listen to E, and he speaks a hip-hop culture language that I need to go to hiphopdictionary.com as he's speaking. Oh, cheddar's money. Oh, okay. And guys, it's not my world. I'd be being dishonest if I said it was my world. Words are part of a culture. You talk to tech people and you listen to them throwing around the language that's normative to them. And if you're not one of those people, they're speaking a foreign language to you, right? So your words help define culture. Cues. Cues are just certain signs and signals that mean something. We understand them. Someone waves, that's a hello. Someone takes off their shoes. Feet be bad. They're a leper if they take off their feet. That's crazy. They take off their shoes, they're being comfortable. Except if you're in a Middle Eastern country, then you're being insulting if you show someone the bottom of your feet. So cues have a way of telling people things. Someone walks into your church, there are cues that you've given before they even have sat down that says what kind of place it is. Is it their environment or someone else? And the final one is artifacts, just the things that are around. Somewhere in the mix of those three things, words, cues, and artifacts that don't have to be translated, that are understood naturally by you and the group of people that you live with, is where you find your cultural incarnation. Take heed to yourself. Figure out who you are. Timothy was unique. He was a half-breed, right? He was part Jew, part Gentile. And he's in Ephesus, this city that was part Jew, part Gentile. I mean, he had a unique place that was his. I came to Christ living on Lark Street, which the Christians lovingly called Dark Street, that we felt the love. And it was the arts community of Albany, right? And there's an expression that's so dangerous to mission. Have you ever heard this expression used? He got saved out of. She got saved out of. How about she got saved for? He got saved for this group. That you're supposed to actually still maintain some sort of cultural connection to these people. Now, the sin stuff has to go. When the words, cues, and artifacts openly defy God, that's not culture anymore. That's just sin. I'm talking about the morally neutral stuff. So here's what they did. They pulled me out of Lark Street. They said, don't hang out with the people there anymore. Because those people are sexually immoral. They sell drugs. They use drugs, and I'm thinking, I got to chuck the whole Rolodex. These are all my friends, I'm not supposed to, and they're artists who don't honor God. All right, what am I supposed to do? You guys introduced me to Jesus, so you must know everything. Buy a tie, buy some Dockers, and cut your hair. Really? I was that far off? Yep, okay. So, now I'm moving into a whole other culture. And what happens is we create cultural incarnation abortions. People who were meant to be somewhere, we steal their culture. And try to just neutralize them in some sort of Christian subculture, and they can't speak to the people that they used to speak to anymore. If when I was done being discipled, and I went through Bible college, and then I went through seminary, and then I went to a suburban town, if I went back to the arts area that I was saved out of, I wouldn't have passed the sniff test anymore. I wouldn't have come off as legitimate. A place that I once loved and the people that I was with. By the time I left, I was having crazy dreams late at night that I had my long hair back and that I was with these people again. And the next church I would plant would be in what would be the emerging arts community of the Capital District in Troy, New York. And I would be back with my people, and I was never so happy and fulfilled in ministry. Because I wasn't called to be a cross-cultural missionary to suburban, red state, upstate New York. I tried, and I want suburban, red state people to go to heaven. I don't want any of them to go to hell. But I'm from New York State. We're not just blue, we're midnight blue, okay? And if the church is only incarnating to red staters, we're missing a lot of lost Democrats in New York State, let me tell you. And we're missing a lot of lost arts people, the people that I communicated with. And when we found that we started living this out in a small group of people, and we created this art ministry that met once a month, we before we knew it, we had 100 people coming out once a month. Lights out. There was no credit. Musicians didn't get credit. Speaker didn't get credit. It was just part of the ethos because artists have a problem with ego a lot of times, and they have to own the stuff. So to fix that, we said, nobody gets known. And we had like 100 people showing up, and eventually we said, well, what do? Well, we started a church that meets in a nightclub. For us, that was a natural cultural incarnation full of words, cues, and artifacts we understand. For some of you, that's going to mean cross-cultural, that you know, yeah, I understand where I am culturally, but God's called me to these other people. You have to learn until you're fluent in thought, word, cues, and artifacts, that culture, before you can show up there. Otherwise, you'll just be imposing another culture and live out the mistakes the church has made in the past. I have a daughter who is taking Spanish. She spends her summers in Mexico and Guatemala. I mean, she is learning that world. That's where she feels called to be. And at some point, you know, she's going to, you know, have it down where she's just able to understand that culture. She gets excited about that culture. When she learns new slang in that culture, you think it was the greatest thing in the world for her. Some of you have grown up as the boy and girl in the plastic bubble, and I want to take a minute to relate to that, because I've had people come up to me after I've spoken saying, hey, I'm who you talked about. I grew up in the Christian bubble. I mean, the first play toy I had was a King David play toy. And then, you know, I had little sheep around me and the Ten Commandments around my wall. I don't have a culture except Wheaton, Illinois. You know, I have like no other culture whatsoever. It's a hard place to be. Those people probably need a little more time of discovery to be able to say, walk out of the bunker. Your parents loved you. They were trying to protect you. But they created a bunker out of some sense of fear that you wouldn't be okay out there in the big bad world. Start walking your walk and figure out the people that you're kind of drawn to. It's a real hard journey, but these people at whatever age have to kind of redo self-discovery. All right, so this is the final piece. If we're thinking about the incarnation, being present, being full of truth, full of grace, we look at the Apostle Paul on Mars Hill and we see, what does he do? He's incredibly present with the philosophers and with the idolaters, and he's full of grace and he's full of truth, and that's what I want to do. I'm looked like Timothy. I've paid heed to myself. I know who I am. I paid heed to my doctrine. I actually listen to what the Bible says the gospel is. What do I do? Well, for us it meant being present with a small group of people, because if it doesn't work with a little group of people, you have no business trying to replicate it on a big level. So we had 3 or 4 people who now became the elders at our church, and we just started doing life together very deeply. We wanted to see what would happen if we were very present with each other. How we would behave the day we didn't like each other. You've got to be careful when you're being recorded. Let's just say we've said some things to each other in ways and with words that you won't find in the Bible, at about 4 inches from each other's faces. But still, we had to learn what it was to actually be mad at these people. Because there are 3 kinds of people you'll do life with. The people that you fake peace with. You don't really know them. You smile, how's it going? Good, how are you? Good. You don't know them, they don't know you, and it's really nice and easy. There are the people who you break peace with. You've decided you don't like them because you're a prideful, stubborn sinner who cannot forgive others and live out the Lord's Prayer, forgive us our trespasses, we forgive others. You've dismissed that person. Man, I hate that guy, right? That woman, I can't stand her. And you see them and your blood just kind of boils, and that's peace breaking. And then there are the people that you will fight with and that you will connect with again after you've gone through a process of repentance. And you will learn what it is to be a community of peace with those people. And that will be stronger than anything else, because you'll have already broken it. I got a big funny knuckle back here in the middle of my hand. It's because my senior year of high school, I was stupid enough to hit a guy in the side of the head, and I broke my hand, and I had to drive a stick shift to the doctor's office. So let me tell you, it's painful when there's a bone sticking through your hand and you're shifting gears. The doctor was a former boxer who lectured me as I'm sitting there with my bone out. Well, here's why you broke it, son. You don't hit here. You got to hit. I'm like, dude, just fix my hand. And he said, well, the good news is you're never going to break that again. Because now that that's healed, it's even going to be stronger and have more calcium on it than there ever was before. I'm like, well, thank you. Next time I go to punch someone in the head, I'll be confident that I won't break my hand. But these relationships got to be like that. These people we lived in real community with, we found out we were together. So go narrow and deep with a small group of people. Understand what it is to live in the gospel. Once that church has started, you have to see what God is doing. So many people go in with this playbook and say, here's how the church is going to work. Here's who we're going to reach. We'll have reached them by month 7. God, when you're not busy, just sign off on that. It may not be the most holy thing to some people, but I like to think of God as a poker dealer. Doc Marcel taught me how to think strategically by playing poker. Poker, you can't be sentimental. You have the cards you have. The guy who loses gets emotional. He's dreaming of the cards that he should have, the one card in the deck that'll save his soul, and he's waiting against odds on it. Or he's so mad because he folded the last hand, and when he watched the rest of the cards come up, he would have won. You can't be emotional when you're being strategic. You have to look at the cards you're dealt. And at some point, you put down the planning and paper aside and say, God, what have you given me to steward over? And how do I best use those resources? How do I best serve those people? You might have a vision for a church, and God has a completely different one. We really thought, because of who we were, our church was just going to be all these artsy people who were constantly showing up, and it was just going to be great, man. It was going to just stink of patchouli and really good folk music. You know, it was going to be wonderful. And I've got FBI agents, DEA agents. We're near one of the best engineering schools in the country. 30% of my church are like nuclear physicists. I was a creative writing major. I mean, the only science I took in college was field biology. You know what that is? You walk around the woods and go, man, some nice trees out there. And you get a C. I mean, that's my only science in college. That's not my church. I mean, the church I had planned, it didn't work out. The church God planned, I now had to steward over. Network in your city. Man, just burn this one into your head. I can't remember where I picked it up, but burn it into your head. Pastor your city, and your city will be your church. If you only dream of pastoring a church, your ministry is going to end at your building. But if you say, I pastor this city, this is the territory that God has. I'm going to watch over this parish. And you start to treat those people like they're your church, that's the assembly. You begin to get to know them. You begin to live out the incarnation. You're present, truthful, and gracious. One of the best compliments I ever had was we had an Acts 29 conference, and Darren Patrick got up to speak after having been in our city a day. And he said, you know what? I mean this in the best way. I think guys at Terra Nova know every bartender, waiter, and waitress in the city. And I thought about, like, that could be taken really bad in the wrong context, right? But he meant that in the real good way, that we talk to these people. Because it's not just the passing masses of people that I'm going to have ministry with. It's the people whose stores are open on the same block as me. We look out for them. You know, we make sure that we're part of that conspiracy they have to make money. So when we tip them, tip well in your own city. I mean, they shouldn't even have to tell Christian church planters that, right? Tip well should be like church planting 101, but they don't teach you that in seminary. Pastor your city, and your city will be your church. Look at your city's needs. E did a great job talking upstairs about what are the needs in your community, not what programs you thought you would have. That's your ambitions versus God's needs for a people. How to be present, how to be truthful, which is really what justice is about, and how to be gracious, which is really what mercy is about. So on a small level, we became present by a service that happens in a nightclub. Makes sense to a lot of people. It has a bar, so it filters out a lot of crazy people, which was nice. We have an art gallery that's open 24/7, and that's a place where the arts community in our city feels like it's theirs. So I go into that gallery, and when we have our city night out, there's about 250 people through there. Only about 10% are from our church, and people don't know me. Like, I'll walk in, they'll look at me like, you know, who are you? And I feel like in a moment I want to say to them, kind of a big deal around here. But, you know, I don't. I just sort of, you know, take some cheese and walk away and go back to my office and let them do their thing. Where we're trying to be truthful, we've decided to engage globally on the human trafficking issue. And we're doing things like locally trying to help educate our police force. on what places look like that are trafficking human beings. And if you don't think it's happening in your city, you're just hiding your head. And on the gray side, we work with some people where there was no in our county, there was no Christian agency working for the homeless, none whatsoever in our county. There was one in the next county, and there were 80-some churches helping them. There was no Christian agency, there was one secular agency, and nobody was helping them. They were doing it on a shoestring, and we said, we want to help you. And they were so gun-shy. They said, no. You want to come in and evangelize everyone. You want to hand every homeless guy and woman with a need a tract. We said, we swear we don't want to do that. We just want to live out the kingdom value of grace and mercy. We want to be able to help. That guy has now come to our church and spoken from our pulpit. We said, not to preach, just come share, you know, what's going on. And he said, you guys are family. You're the first line of people that I count on when we need volunteers. And the people that we're ministering to aren't the people who are passing through with the daily homeless needs, but the staff in that place, they look at us and they smell the aroma of something different, and they know that we're Christians. We're present in our city. Pass to your city, and your city will be your church. So I guess that's what I would say about missionality, you know, pre and post launch. Listen well to Paul. Take heed to yourself and to your doctrine. Live well like Paul. Stand in a place where you can be full of truth and full of grace, and live out John chapter 1, verse 14.